I call to order the Ways and Means hearing for Wednesday, April 16th. Mr. Smith will note the roll. Representative Davids moves approval of the minutes from April 2nd and April 5th. Are there any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Minutes are approved as distributed. We're going to first take up the Swedinsky bill, House File 2786. Representative Davids moves approval of House File 2786. Welcome to the committee if you'd like to explain your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 2786 is a pretty straightforward bill. We've had a few cities throughout the state, I believe about 18, that failed to get their paperwork in, file the necessary requirements to the state in order to receive their LGA payments. A number of them have completed their paperwork, to my understanding, but there are a number that have not. This bill simply extends the deadline to May 31st of this year for those cities to complete their paperwork to receive their 2011 local government aid payment. That is pretty much it. A few of the cities that have had routine failures to get their paperwork in have changed. A few have contracted with other cities. Just something to keep in mind, a committee, Madam Chair, is simply that, you know, a lot of these cities are small. Some of the folks that are in elected positions in these cities sometimes don't know that they have been elected until the morning after the election. And so sometimes getting the paperwork done and figuring out how the operation works is a tough process, and I appreciate committee support. So thank you.
And there's an A3 amendment to the packet. I believe it makes technical changes, and there's a transposition of numbers that also has to be corrected. Representative Davids?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Any questions on the A3 amendments? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The A3 amendment is adopted. Any questions on the bill as amended? Representative Lancheski.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I don't really have a question for the author. I just encourage folks bipartisanly here to oppose this bill. Members, this is a forgiveness note for a bunch of cities who aren't doing what they're supposed to be. They are supposed to report, and for many of us around the table, our constituents pay higher taxes so that other communities can get local government aid, and we would ask that they at least have to report in a timely fashion. Madam Chair, this, as you know, local government aid, you're the Ways and Means Chair, you know that the taxpayers across the state spend $500 million a year to give money to these communities, and they can't even get their reports in. Now, I understand this is a broad forgiveness bipartisanly, but it's actually quite ridiculous. We now have the situation where 40% of our cities are not meeting their requirements to the state auditor in a timely fashion. Now, this is only 28. We have 854 cities. I think it's 28 or 24. I'm not sure what it is. But we can, allowing this forgiveness to go on says, you know, we don't really mean it when we raise taxes on people and then do wealth redistribution in the state, and you don't have to report, and, you know, oh, if times are tough, it's just okay. It isn't okay. This bill, you know, I'm sure is probably just a tax vehicle for other purposes. If it was legitimate, it belonged in the omnibus tax bill. But members, if you look through the list, and it is bipartisan, there, I'm sure, are some hard luck stories here, but this is just a broad forgiveness. And we have a state law. This is not a local decision. This is a state significant tax program. We spend about $1 billion a year in tax aid to communities, whether it's fiscal disparities, local government aid, county program aid, and this is a big one. I mean, $500 million a year. And so we ask that when we give these gifts to these cities, that quite frankly a lot of our constituents get tired of giving, we ask that you get your report in. That's it. It's not too tough. So, you know, the state auditor has to review that these cities are meeting the requirements, and this is sort of, you know, it's not a no-strings-attached program. And, in fact, I have watched the current majority say we ought to limit local government aid just to police or just to public works, or cities of the first class shouldn't get it because they have a sales tax, or, you know, we generally hear this sort of rhetoric of tightening the LGA and proving that you won't buy a water fountain or whatever. And now what this bill does is said, we're going to say, actually, we don't mean any of that, and you don't have to report. So members, you all, every one of your constituents, whether you're a recipient of this program or not, and about half of Minnesotans, just for the public, Madam Chair, half of Minnesotans live in a community that does not receive local government aid. Now, it's a small set of cities, but those cities have a lot of people who live in them, and a bunch of us here bipartisanly represent those people. So half of the Minnesotans in this state do not receive local government aid. Half. Yet they pay for it. And the other half receive it, and they pay for it, too. We all pay for it, but only half of Minnesotans are beneficiaries. And just like JobZ or any other tax credit program, like an angel investor credit, we make people come in and do their accounting. So I hope members will, my guess is it's going to pass because it's here, but I want for the record, Madam Chair, and I appreciate you allowing the comments, that this is a forgiveness of failing to report, and it is, Minnesotans pay higher income and sales taxes to pay for this program, and I'd urge people to vote no.
Jimmy, what do you got?
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, I have a question, Madam Chair, of the author. Does Department of Revenue give out any kind of a reminder notice to these, or to cities generally, that their paperwork is due?
Representative Sudzinski.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, yes, I believe they've got a series of notes and letters that they send to the mayor, to the city clerk, and also to the representatives that represent the cities within the legislature. I don't have an exact line of when those dates are. Actually, I probably have a little bit here. It's they usually give a month notice every 30 days up until September, and then they're getting final notice that they obviously will not be receiving when they don't get their check. But kind of also in response to that question, but also to Representative Luncheski's point, some of the city, my city of Vesta, happened to go through a national disaster. They did happen to have a tornado that came through town. You know, that's really where this bill came from. I don't believe it's a vehicle bill. I've carried other vehicle bills in the past, mostly deal with cars, but I think this bill is pretty straightforward. Rather than select the cities in which we're going to be receiving and not, I decided to let's put all the cities together that have not received their paperwork. This isn't a forgiveness. This is a simple extension of timeline to get their work done, and I think the state does need to, and it's in a duty to require that the cities have their paperwork done. We felt because of the extenuating circumstances of some cities, and rather than picking and choosing winners and losers, we decided to put the cities together in this bill, and I'd appreciate your green vote. So,
any other questions?
Madam Chair, yeah, he went beyond my question, I think it's important to note then that they were given notice that the paperwork was due, and the author indicates that notice was given several times, apparently. We're all facing a deadline tomorrow. I mailed my taxes in today. We're aware that we all have certain deadlines that we have to meet, and they apparently, for whatever reason, chose not to meet the deadlines, even when they were given reminder notices. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll also note that of the 18 cities listed on the House Research Bill Summary, 9 of them were given filing extensions and still missed, given the fact that they were even given extensions. So I'd have to agree with my colleague from Bloomington.
All right. Seeing no other comments, Representative David renews his motion that House File 2786 as amended be recommended passed and referred to the General Register. Office. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay.
No.
Motion prevails. The next bill in front of us will be House File 1476. Representative Scott. And members, first we need a motion to move this bill from the table. So I will make that motion. All those in favor?
Madam Chair, I'd like a roll call.
All right. And Representative Carlson has asked for a roll call on the motion to move House File 1476 from the table. Any questions on that? Seeing none, Mr. Smith will note the roll. Take the vote.
Representative Holberg.
Yes.
Representative Downey.
Yes.
Representative Carlson.
No.
Representative Abler.
Yes.
Representative Bruce Anderson.
Yes.
Representative Sarah Anderson.
Yes.
Representative Beard.
Aye.
Representative Breinert.
No.
Representative Biskins.
Yes.
Representative Champion.
No.
Representative Davids.
Yes.
Representative Eakin.
No.
Representative Garofalo.
Yes.
Representative Gottwald.
Yes.
Representative Greiling.
No.
Representative Gunther.
Yes.
Representative Hackbarth.
Aye.
Representative Hamilton.
Yes.
Representative Hornstein.
No.
Representative Howes.
No.
Representative Huntley. Representative Kahn.
No.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Aye.
Representative Lanning.
Yes.
Representative Lanchesky.
No.
Representative McNamara.
Yes.
Representative Nornes.
Yes.
Representative Pulowski.
No.
Representative Rukavina. Representative Slawik.
No.
Representative Smith.
No.
Representative Wagenius.
No.
Representative Westrom.
By a vote of 17 ayes and 13 nays, the motion to remove House File 1476 from the table prevails. I will then move House File 1476 for consideration by the committee. When we left off with this bill, we have a committee engrossment in the file that reflects the amendments that were placed on the bill in the committee. We also have copies of the original bill and the amendments that were adopted in the previous committee hearing. In addition, there's two additional amendments for today, the A7 and the A8 amendment. In addition to that, there is an updated fiscal note in the packet as well. Representative Scott, welcome back to the committee. And we have an A7 amendment which will place the appropriation of $192,000 from the general fund to reflect the total cost of the fiscal note. Are there any questions on the A7 amendment?
Move it.
Seeing none, all those in favor of the A7 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The A7 amendment is adopted. We now have the A8 amendment in front of us, and if you'd like to speak to the A8 amendment that actually amends the A4 amendment from the previous agenda related to a study, and given the $80,000 cost that was attributed to that study in the fiscal note, the A8 amendment would remove the study and the $80,000 from the bill that we just amended. And I would move the A8 amendment, and if you'd like to speak to that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say, you know, it's fine to remove it and all that. I think it is should be the purview of each agency to keep track of numbers like this. I think it's only fair to the taxpayers, but in the interest of moving this bill along and saving the $80,000, go ahead and vote.
Members, any questions on the A8 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The A8 amendment is adopted. I think we now have the bill in the shape in which the author would like to consider it. Are there any additional questions? Representative Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members, and the audience. I voted yes today. I don't believe in this bill. I don't think it's going to become law the way it is. I think it's a problem. I commend the Representative Scott and McNamara for their work on this. There are some people here today and listening who are terrified about the prospect of their jobs and what this might mean. I think there are some things that could be worked out in an amiable way that still could go forward in this bill, which is why I'm voting to move it out today. I do know the current form, it will not become law. So I urge the people who are working on this, who are trying to, in the name of labor, trying to give the labor individuals some more flexibility in their scheduling, especially outstate, where they can only have to work 4 days to get their 40 hours in, if that makes sense, and save some $4 gas. That part appeals to me. Other parts that I think are quite a ways off, and especially given the tense environment. So I hope that the people on both sides of the aisle recognize my sincerity in trying to find a way, a path to here to get a bill signed that can actually relieve some of the burden on the working man who's had the most challenging bit of time in the last couple of years, and the contractors for trying to stay open to hire the working man. And so that's why I'm voting yes, and I urge members to support the bill today.
All right, thank you. Members, it's been brought to my attention that we do need to amend the A7 amendment that was adopted at this point so that the numbers work. And so on the A7 amendment, line 5, delete $192,000 and insert $112,000. Any questions on that? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The oral amendment is adopted. Any additional questions? Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, just as a reminder, we know that this bill has very strong opposition from representatives of the labor movement. Actually, many years ago, I chaired a special subcommittee that dealt with this issue, and I might have commented about that the other day. And a similar proposal was voted down by a very strong bipartisan vote at the time in opposition to repealing the prevailing wage. And we actually had presentations at that time from both labor and contractors that were lined up with labor, if you will, in opposition to removing the prevailing wage provisions from law. And so this morning, with that history in mind, I would encourage, Madam Chair, a no vote on this bill and also, again, request a roll call vote.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. A roll call vote is requested. Representative Godwell.
Madam Chair and members, just for the record, we are not repealing prevailing wage in this bill. We are reforming it. This is the way that most other states do it. And I get tired of that characterization, Representative Carlson, that we're repealing prevailing wage. We are not in this bill, and I just want to make sure that we're clear about that.
Representative Carlson.
No, Madam Chair, it greatly changes current law, and you can characterize it as not repealing, or I can characterize it as repealing, but at any rate, it greatly amends current law, and that's why I'm opposed.
Thank you. Any additional comments? Representative Reinhardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to inquire of Representative Gottwald about the, his comment that this is the way that most other states do it. That is not my understanding, so I'd like a little clarification on exactly what elements of the law he thinks are parallel to other state laws.
Representative Gottwald.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Reinhardt, and I'll ask the author to confirm this. Minnesota is one of the few states that determines prevailing wage under the current method. We are talking here about moving to the method by which virtually every other state that does prevailing wage calculates this. This has been a problem. We've seen news reports about how prevailing wage is currently being calculated, the cost that's added to projects without adding a single additional job in the state of Minnesota. But perhaps Representative Scott, if you could perhaps comment on how many states do it the way we do it now and how many do it the way we're proposing to do it.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're one of only three states that currently do the pure modal figuring for prevailing wage. We're California, Hawaii, and Minnesota.
Representative Reinhardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Scott, what about the other half of that, and that is what how many states do it according to the method proposed in this bill?
Representative Scott.
I'm not sure if I have that data with me. I had it when it was heard last time, but I think I don't want to quote because I might be off base, but I know that we're one of only three states that do pure modal.
Representative
Reinhardt. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'm not wanting to debate with you about that here, but my point is I think that we're moving in a direction that isn't common to most states in the United States in terms of a methodology, and I think that ought to be clarified in this discussion. I don't think that we're aligning ourselves with most other states. I think there's two or three other methodologies in between what we currently do and what we're proposing that we haven't explored or discussed.
Thank you. Any other questions before we take the roll call vote? I'm sorry, Representative Rukavina. I heard you had a foot of snow up there this morning.
It was over my head, Madam Chair. And just the reason I want to speak this morning, because, you know, there's a few construction workers in the room I see back there. And, you know, this may be one of only three states, Representative Scott, but we're probably one of only three states that's trying to take people money out of people's pockets, working people. You haven't done it enough this session, I take. Now you got to do more here. You know, when it's snowing up north and Menards is being put up, and I don't like that fact that Menards is going up in my district, but, you know, that's life. That's the way it goes. Big chain stores come in, put the little Main Street people out of business, but the construction workers are working there, and they're working at prevailing wage. But today they can't work. You know, it seems to be a fact that people can't grasp around here. These people work a full-time job, but they don't work a full-time job and a 40-hour week because they can't. It's the nature of this business. It's the nature of our state. As I drove down today, it left my driveway with about 8 inches of snow, which was still up to my knees, I might add, you know. But I just cannot believe that, you know, we are doing this to working men and women and to the middle class, and we just keep hammering and hammering. Our methodology hasn't cost the businesses in this state anymore. It certainly hasn't cost the government. When you use, in my area at least, union wages, union labor, you get oftentimes the best job around, most times the best job around, and the government and the businesses save money in the end. And why you would want to change what's been law for years and years and years and go after the middle class and just keep doing it and doing it and doing it is beyond me. So I don't care if we're one of only one state in the nation. It's the right way to do it. But I can guarantee you the other states that have prevailing wages, I hope, after the foolishness we've seen going on in this country for the last year and a half or so, that other states aren't attempting to take more and more away from their particularly union people, but in this case prevailing wage being paid, because the other states are learning a lesson, and I'm hoping that that lesson will be learned here in November. So do what you want, but to say that we're one of only three states, we're one of only three states taking money out of people's pockets, hard-working people who work in the conditions that I just described, and to pick their pockets is beyond me.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just a quick and maybe final comment, but Mr. Melander testified before the committee the other day that this repeal of the way it's currently calculated or amending the way it's currently calculated without getting into a debate on that issue. Representative Scott, do you have any idea what kind of a pay cut you would be causing as a result of this amendment to the current law?
Representative Scott.
Do you have any idea what you're doing?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I do, Representative Carlson. And, you know, we're in tight fiscal restraints in this state, and we're trying to make some reforms that are gradual and moderate. These are not overwhelming reforms that we're talking about. They're very moderate.
Madam Chair, that wasn't the question I was asking. You can describe it in any way you would like, but I was asking you what kind of a pay cut you would be imposing on construction workers in the state of Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Carlson, this bill is an effort to reform prevailing wage, possibly making our state more attractive to other businesses to come in and do work here, and could possibly save our state around $50 million a year in construction costs. That's a lot more roads and bridge projects that would put more people back to work.
Well, Representative Madam Chair, you know, obviously she's trying to share with us her philosophy, but she is not providing an answer to the question. I would think if you were carrying a major bill like this, you'd want to know what kind of a cut you were imposing on the workers in the state of Minnesota that are in the construction trades.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll just be brief. You know, I noticed on here that they talk a little bit about the local impact, but doesn't this impact our school districts too? Because are they required to pay a prevailing wage right now? Would they see a cost savings under something like this in the 80 counties that are impacted by it?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, they would.
All right. Seeing no further Representative Breinhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly for the record, I did find the reference I was looking for earlier and couldn't get to quickly enough, but our own legislative auditor in the 2007 report does indicate that only two other states in the country actually use a mean to calculate prevailing wages. So the other options in between, you know, which are some variations on the mode or other, or using a wage agreed to in collective bargaining, are other ways other states approach prevailing wage. And my only issue there is to say we're not conforming with the majority of states in the country in this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things to remember in this matter is that that was done in 2007. I'm not sure if there have been any other states that have moved and made any of those changes. Again, this is, as Representative Abler alluded to, this is a work in progress, and we are certainly open to negotiating and talking more about this issue as it moves forward.
All right. Mr. Smith will note the roll.
Representative Holberg.
Yes.
Representative Downey.
Yes.
Representative Carlson.
No.
Representative Abler.
Yes.
Representative Bruce Anderson.
Yes.
Representative Sarah Anderson.
Yes.
Representative Beard.
Aye.
Representative Breinert.
No.
Representative Biskins.
Yes.
Representative Champion.
No.
Representative Davids.
Yes.
Representative Eakin.
No.
Representative Garofalo.
Yes.
Representative Gottwald.
Yes.
Representative Greiling.
No.
Representative Gunther.
Yes.
Representative Hackbarth.
Aye.
Representative Hamilton.
Yes.
Representative Hornstein.
No.
Representative Howes.
No.
Representative Huntley. Representative Kahn.
No.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Aye.
Representative Lanning.
Yes.
Representative Lanchesky.
No.
Representative McNamara.
Yes.
Representative Nornes.
Yes.
Representative Pawlowski.
No.
Representative Rukavina.
No.
Representative Slawick.
No.
Representative Smith.
No.
Representative Wagenius.
No.
Representative Westrom.
With a vote of 17 ayes and 14 nays, the motion prevails. The bill is approved and moved to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Scott. The next bill on the agenda is House File 322. I would move House File 322 for consideration by the committee. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 322 establishes a rebuttable presumption of joint physical custody and equal shared parenting for two fit parents. We have put in many exceptions and protections and have allowed for geographical distance in this bill. And this bill has had six hearings in the House. Currently, we have a disagreement with the courts on what the fiscal cost of implementation would be. You should have some handouts there as to what other states have done. What it has or has not cost other states that have either a bill similar to this that's moving or already has a bill similar to this that is actually law. And I'm here to ask for the committee's support.
All right, and there is an A9 amendment which will change the effective date. Members, as you can see with the fiscal note, there is current biennial impact. The adoption of the A9 amendment would push the impact into the next biennium, which, of course, is an issue with that biennium. At this point, I'd move the A9 amendment. Are there any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The A9 amendment is adopted. Members, the bill is in the shape in which the author would like to discuss it. Are there any questions? Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I look at the fiscal note, and it says no on local impact. And I am wondering if we are changing the legal standard here, and I haven't been on the Judiciary Committee, so I don't know where we're going, but so once we change the legal standard, aren't all custody agreements open for rechange? And doesn't that have an enormous impact on the court costs?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Wagenius, one of the handouts that I have there for you is a fiscal impact study from Australia. They had a joint fiscal custody bill and law in place for a number of years. And if you look at that handout, you'll see that there's been very little cost to their courts. In fact, in some cases, the number of people coming in to file for what we might call a post-decree motion has actually gone down. Oklahoma has a law like this in place, and there hasn't been any fiscal impact there. And the number of cases, you'll see the filings of the number of cases as well in Australia it went up in a few cases, but not anything astronomical since implementation.
Representative Genius.
I don't think you can, since family law is very localized, comparing with Australia does nothing, and even comparing with another state doesn't do much. What we're doing is changing Minnesota's system, and once you say for some parents you can change the presumptions, then it seems to me that you are opening the door, it has to be opening the door, for all sorts of folks to go back into court. And that is the question about this local, there's no impact. I find that astounding, and I also find it astounding that there's so little in the state.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Wagenius. The post-decree filing is not, no one can come in and come back in for a post-decree filing until a year after this bill has been implemented. So that gives the court some time to come up to speed with how to handle these cases. But secondly, Representative Wagenius, just because there's going to be a fiscal impact, I don't know if you've gotten any letters from any non-custodial parents and children that have been without the input of one of their parents in their lives. I think this is a small amount of money to invest in making families, in making children have close to equal access to both parents as possible. And you will find, I think, that there'll be savings in other areas to the state because these children children come from single parent homes, have a higher rate of teen suicide, drug abuse, teen pregnancy, a whole plethora of social problems that our state and county levels are currently paying for. I think there'll be cost savings established through this move.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I don't think you can say that this won't go into effect for a year after for new cases. Old cases can't go into effect for a year. It's a denial of equal protection. So that doesn't seem right to me. Somebody's going to challenge that. But the more important thing is the assumption that this experiment will save folks money. We have no idea whether that is the case or not. And I don't, for one, believe it at all. So to assume that you can use the model of single parent raising a child and then say those kids have additional problems and then moving it over and saying this will solve that problem, There's no relationship. So I am very troubled by changing the standard we have in this state, which is the best interests of the child, to essentially moving to a parent standard, which is the best interests of the parent. So it's troubling to me, and Madam Chair, I think it's extraordinarily. We're taking a huge, expensive road that is probably not good for children either. So if I was persuaded that it was good for children, then we might want to take on that expense. But there's no way to persuade that changing the standard is good for children. So then why would we take on this enormous expense?
Representative Champion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have a couple questions for Representative Scott. Representative Scott, I noticed on 8.8 of your bill that it talks about, 8.8, that the judiciary in contested court proceedings shall demonstrate consistent application of the rebuttable presumption. Can you tell me, based on your information, how many cases thus far are you filed, and how many cases do you anticipate will be contested as a result of this new legislation if it goes forward?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is in the fiscal note. The fiscal note, they give an estimate there of how many cases they think will be coming forward out of that. Let me find it.
Madam Chair.
Representative Champion.
I know, Representative Scott, that is articulated or outlined in the fiscal note, but I'm sure that you have some thought whether that information is correct, wrong, or if you're challenged by it, because I heard you earlier say that you are at a loss as to how the courts are determining that there's going to be an increased cost to it. So I'm a little surprised with your response. So okay. Could you be so kind as
sure.
to answer my question?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, there are some hard numbers in this report, and there are some soft numbers in this report. The hard numbers are they know how many cases right now and in the past few years have been filed. What we maintain with this bill is this bill, because people will go in on even footing, both parents will go into this this action on an equal footing, we maintain that the number of contested cases will go down. It will reduce conflict because, again, both parents know going in that they're on equal footing.
Madam Chair.
Representative Champion.
Representative Scott. Maybe I should ask this so that I'm very clear about the bill. I've heard it a couple of times. So when we think in terms of this bill, does this bill also pertain or impact unmarried parents? So let's say, for an example, if I'm not married to, I see my good friend Shantara Hardy there. Let's say that we had a child out of wedlock.
She's really embarrassed.
I thought I would use that opportunity just to embarrass her, Madam. But let's say two parents have a child out of wedlock, but then there's an issue around custody. So would two unmarried individuals who are the biological parents of a child, would this bill impact them?
Yes. Oh, sorry, Madam Chair. Yes, it would. Under equal protection under the law, it's been proven in the Supreme Court that you have to treat married and unmarried individuals the same.
Madam Chair, follow up.
Champion.
So with that, is it not true that based on two unmarried individuals, that there's an extra step or two that has to be determined before we even get to the issue of custody? Isn't that right?
Representative Scott.
I believe there are, but those are already, nothing in those laws will change.
Representative Champion.
Thank you. So I understand that that's not going to change, but I'm getting more to what this committee's purview is around finances, right, and money and cost. So if there's an added step that would require unwed parents to also establish paternity, because isn't that something that has to be established before you can get to the issue of custody?
That's as it is.
Representative Scott.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. That's as it is now.
Representative Champion.
And so with that being said, isn't it true that now there's this cost that is additional to the courts, because if you have unmarried folks with their kids coming in, and there's this extra step of paternity, because you have to establish paternity, are these folks usually represented by counsel or unrepresented?
Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, I guess that varies. We have an individual that did a court case study, and it's kind of all over the place as far as who has a lawyer and who can afford one and who can't. A lot of people are going pro se now.
So,
Representative Champion.
Madam Chair, with that being said, is it your understanding, based on your read of the studies and talking to the courts, that when there's an unrepresented party before the courts, does it take more or less of the court's time in order to facilitate that process?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess that's something we've never had a discussion on with the courts, to be honest.
Madam Chair.
Representative Champion.
It's because, in my understanding, when you look at the cost to the court, that is an important question, because now you have an additional burden on the court, and based on the fiscal note, it says that that's one of the uncertainties, is because they know, number one, that when parties are unrepresented, that it takes more time to facilitate that case or the process, because they want to make sure that these unlearned folks understand the process. So that takes more staff time, that takes more of the judge's time, and so I just want to focus on whether you believe that there's going to be an additional cost, because that is the reality that the courts are faced with.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Champion. No, I do not. I don't believe that at all.
Madam Chair.
Representative Champion.
Okay, so if you don't believe that, I'm reading here in the fiscal note where it says, under the current law, because the recognition of parentage does not give any custody or parenting time rights to the father, the custodial mother has sole legal and sole physical custody until a court orders otherwise. Thus, currently in such cases, an order is issued and the custodial mother receives a child support award under the guidelines as a sole physical custodian. It is unclear how a presumption of joint physical custody would apply in these cases. The Department of Human Services would have to set rules, and the courts would interpret how this would be applied. This lack of uncertainty would also apply to those cases where the parties do not sign a recognition of parentage and the county initiates a paternity action. Right? You also will see in the fiscal note that there will be an increase in a cost based on post-judgment motions. And right now it says an increase. This is in the fiscal note. An increase in post-judgment motions could also result from confusion over the appropriate custody modification standards. Now, as we look at the standard that is being changed in your bill, it's my understanding there would be this rebuttable presumption only based on limited circumstances, such as if there's, you know, child some abuse, or if you can prove that some parent has been negligent. Is that right?
Representative Scott.
Yes, we have the same standards as removing a child from from a home in a CHIPS case, child in need of protection, child in need of protection.
Madam Chair.
Champion.
And with that being said, the standard for a CHIPS case, which for those who don't know is children in need of protection and or services, is that the standard is clear and convincing evidence. Is that right?
Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
So the difference, though, in your case, in your proposed legislation and the CHIPS cases, in the CHIPS case, if the state is able to prove by clear and convincing evidence that a child is in need of protection and or services, there is a case plan that's put in place, and if that parent adheres to the case plan, that that child is reunified or will always be reunified with their family, correct?
Representative Scott and Representative Champion, I'm kind of drifting here. So.
No, this is still getting to the financial issues. I'm trying to just at least lay it out so we can get to the financial question.
We're waiting.
Okay.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. I almost called you, Your Honor. Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Overruled.
Madam Chair, I think there was a question there.
I'm not sure that there was, so maybe if we can succinctly get to the point here.
So, in
some of us aren't attorneys.
So, in this proposed bill, is it not true that no longer, when we look at custody issues, that we would not look at what's in the best interest of the child as it is right now under Minnesota Statute 518?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a question I can answer. The best interest standards are subject to the CHIP standards in this bill.
Representative Champion.
And would you not agree that when we think in terms of the route that is taken in order to get to this proposed legislation, if it was to become law, that the varied aspects of how you get there will add some burden or some unhidden cost that we don't really know about today? Would you agree with that or disagree with that?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Champion, I don't think that we know. I don't think that we can say that. I don't think that the courts can say that, because we don't know.
Representative Reinhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my line of thinking here sort of takes off from Representative Wagenius's issues around whether we really know whether legal costs will be reduced through this bill or whether they will be increased. And I know that's also where Representative Champion was going, but I need to just say a few things as background on the basis of Representative Scott's introductory remarks related to the gains to be made from shared parenting itself. I'm going to say that I have been discussing this issue since before I came to the legislature, because I have a large number of fathers in my community who have been involved in moving this bill, and I probably spent hundreds of hours in conversation, in reading research, in listening to both parent advocacy groups and domestic abuse advocates and mediators and lawyers and judges. Every single person I've encountered in the last 6 years that had any connection to this issue, I've asked what they think about this issue. And after all of that, and I'm a strong advocate for shared parenting, and I think we need to figure out how it is as a society and a state we can promote shared parenting in the daily lives of our kids, whether it's in a divorce situation or any other situation. However, I've yet to be convinced that focusing on this statute and the legal presumption of shared parenting is the best way for us to get at advocating for shared parenting in children's lives. And the reason is that the majority of parents work out these issues in a divorce, work out these issues outside of the courts. 95% come to their own resolution. The 5% who don't obviously have some issues between them in terms of communication and conflict resolution, or they wouldn't be in that extreme situation. So I'm very concerned about moving the focus from the best interest of the child to the rights of the parent. That, to me, is the heart of the matter. And I know one can argue that the rights of the parent are in the best interest of the child, but I'm talking about legally, the exact legal definition of the best interest of the child. And when we move to the clear and convincing evidence rule, I think that we're losing judicial discretion. The judge no longer, you say parents come into this on an even footing. Well, that's the problem. And a great many of those cases in that 5%, parents aren't on an even footing. And this doesn't allow the judge to look at what is the real situation of these individual people in front of me. It requires the judge to accept that they're on an even footing, even though they might not be practically.
Senator Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for bringing this bill forward. You know, I'm not an attorney, but I was raised by a single parent, a single mother. You know, I think about it, and I can remember the custody battles and stuff like that as well, and how my dad did want to be able to spend more time with his children. And, you know, even though my mom and dad were both good people, they hated each other, and they didn't talk much. And so I spent every other weekend with my dad and maybe a couple weeks in the summer. And I know, as a child, I would have liked to have been able to spend more with the father, right? And but unfortunately, it didn't happen. And so I appreciate the fact that you're bringing this forward and that the father can have some say in it. Because like I said, even though my mom is a wonderful, wonderful person, I love her dearly. I'm a mama's boy, you know. And but my dad was too, right? So, yeah, so I appreciate you bringing this forward. I guess my question to the author is the concern that I have in the event that a woman is a battered woman, right, and the children, what protections will they have to where the person that's doing the abuse is not able to make her life even more miserable by dragging her in the court and stuff like that? That would be my question.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hamilton, for sharing that. Domestic abuse is still against the law. This bill does not change that. And all that we're asking in this bill is that what we're trying to get around, and I bet everyone around this table has gotten a letter from most likely a father who's been falsely accused of something, and that automatically disqualifies them in the custody battle. And so there are protections in here for domestic abuse, and the last thing we want to do is put anyone in harm's way.
Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to go back to the amendment that was adopted that kicked the cost of this into the next biennium. And want to compliment you in requesting that we be informed with tracking the costs of the various bills that are going through the legislature. But just a reminder to the committee, as of April 5th, we're adding to the February forecast, which was a shortfall of $1.3 billion, over $200 million in future obligations, bringing us then to $1.5 if all of this were to become law. And each one of these increments is kicking more and more into the next biennium and creating a greater and greater deficit. And I just want to remind people that we are the last stop is a fiscal committee, and we have to keep these kinds of issues in mind. I would hope that the majority party would be fiscally responsible when we look at what these future obligations are, and I'm quite concerned. Now, the major one here is the tax bill. I understand that. But having said that, whether it's the tax bill or this bill or other bills that are coming forward, we're over $200 million in future obligations beyond the forecast.
Representative Champion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to clarify something based on the bill for to Representative Hamilton. Representative Hamilton, as it pertains to domestic abuse, if you look at page 9, that there is this presumption that would be in place, right? And it would be on the other party to challenge the presumption by clear and convincing evidence. And so a person who's been the victim of domestic abuse, if you look specifically at line 9.16, they'd have to, there's that notion there. But here's where the kicker is in 9.17, and specifically, if you look at, starting at 9.17, a parent has petitioned for an order for protection and the petition has been dismissed or denied by the court, or a order for protection was filed by agreement of the parties without a finding of domestic abuse. So sometimes people can be petitioned and go to court, and the person would just say, without there being a court finding, I'll just agree to, you know, the domestic abuse order because I don't want to go through the evidentiary process. So if such a person comes before the court, and that's been the order of the day as far as a no finding, now that person
who's been the victim of domestic abuse has to now prove by clear and convincing evidence that they were abused by this particular person, because there's no previous order that articulated the court's finding. So when you think in terms of a person who's been the victim of domestic abuse, there is an added burden, and they are going to have to try to now regurgitate that, bring that forward, or the court just flatly just deny it because there was no finding.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Hamilton.
Oh, thank you. And what I just...
If I might, just real quickly, for members of the audience, this will be the last bill that we'll be able to do this morning. So if you're here for another bill, we'll have to come back after session to address those. Yeah. Representative Hamilton.
Well, and just to follow up to that, what I'm concerned about is that we punish everybody because of bad actors. You know, even the good fathers. That's my concern. So how do we get to this, to where the good parents have an equal footing, but yet we can still get to the bad actors?
All right, Representative Kahn.
Yes, Madam Chairman and Representative Scott, I have a question about this bill that no one has ever answered, which is, how is a decision made in the case of nursing mothers?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is a question that we haven't gone over a lot, but I think in that case, most likely, the two parents are going to be what's going to happen here, folks, is the two parents going into a custody issue are going to have time to work this thing out on their own. And if they don't, then the judge steps in, okay? So, first of all, our first hope would be that the parents are going to work that out. And maybe they defer. This bill doesn't say that you have to, out of the chute, both parents have 45.1% parenting time. They can work out any agreement that they like to. If 2080 works better for them, they can do that. This bill allows flexibility. So our hope would be with the nursing mother that the dad's going to go, okay, I'm going to cut you a break here. Let's have you have primary time with the child right now. And again, that's the judge will make the final decision if those two can't come up with an agreement.
Well,
Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, this bill only really applies where people can't come up with an agreement. And it seems to me that's a particular, you know, there obviously aren't many cases where we'd be looking at. We'd be looking at a newborn or early infancy child. But it's a perfect way for the father to be abusive to a mother, for example, who wants to nurse, by insisting that they have it. And I obviously don't have an amendment prepared now, but would you object to an amendment that explicitly excluded the case of nursing mothers for the time of feeding, of nursing the child, from any consideration of this?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kahn, I can talk with you off the line about that.
Any additional questions or comments? Seeing none, I renew my motion that House File 322, as amended, be recommended pass, referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Members, we are in recess to the call of chair after session.
Okay.
Call back to order the Ways and Means Committee hearing for Monday, April 16th. Representative Sanders, I will move Senate File 2324. To be considered before the committee. And my understanding is the A1 amendment is yours, if you'd like to briefly describe that.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The A1 is largely technical. It was a drafting oversight. We worked with the Department of Labor and Industry to make sure that we got the language correct. It just inserts the correct terminology, satellite system installer and satellite system contractor, into the bill.
All right, members, in order to get the bill in the shape that I'd like to discuss, I move the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Sanders, if you'd like to briefly describe your bill, and in particular the fiscal note for the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 2324 is a bill to help address an unnecessary burden facing businesses in our state that sell and install satellite television systems. We have more than 500 of those retailers in our state. Many are small independent business owners who sell the satellite systems. Most include installation of the satellite system, even though those systems are designed so that the homeowners can install them themselves. We've worked on this bill with a number of groups, including the Department of Labor and Industry, the IBEW, and this bill is also or is supported by the Satellite Broadcasting and Communications Association and the Minnesota Retailers Association. Until 2002, there were no requirements of any kind for individuals who install satellite systems. In 2002, the low-voltage technician license was put into place, and satellite installers were swept into those requirements. They then were also had to learn swimming pools, heating and air conditioning, things that went far above and beyond what it required to install satellite systems. With that, this is a separate licensing structure for satellite installers, which would allow a small increase into the state or into the fund for that. So that's where you see a small positive impact on the fiscal note.
All right, thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, I'll renew. I'm sorry, Representative Reinhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just see that we have a fiscal note, and I wondered if Representative Sanders would speak to it.
I think he just did.
I must have not.
To the state.
Okay. Sorry. I'll just.
All right. Any other questions? Seeing none, all those in favor of Senate File 2324 as amended, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Representative Sanders. Representative Hamilton.
Was that the first one?
Yep.
I voted. Thanks.
I voted.
Welcome to the committee if you'd like to move your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will move. We operating on the Senate file?
We are. Senate File 248.
All right.
Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll move Senate File 248.
Thank you.
You recommended to pass and place back on the general register.
All righty. And then we have the A1 amendment.
Madam Chair, and this is why we're here, the A1 amendment. And I'll describe that briefly. In the bill that did pass out of Commerce Committee, we did send it to the floor because it talked about a study. And the language talked about to the extent available as far as appropriation. Well, individuals wanted that a little more clear and made sure that we did indeed have the money available and to, like I said, clarify that. So in the A1 amendment, it talks about the appropriation. It adds Section 3, and it will cost $137,000, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. And it's my understanding that this bill will be paid for in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Representative Slavik.
Madam Chair, that's my question. One, this is a contentious issue, and I think it's good that you found a compromise. $137,000 from the Healthcare Access Fund. So is that an approved expenditure? Can the Healthcare Access Funds be used for a study?
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would ask maybe also the chairs of Health and Human Services, if Representative Gottwald or someone would like to weigh in on this as well, because, like I said, this is covered in the Omnibus Health and Human Services bill, and we just wanted to secure the dollars for this standalone bill, if you will. And so if I could, Madam Chair, to yield to Representative Gottwald.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hamilton, and thanks for the question, Representative Slavik. The answer is yes, absolutely. I mean, if we decide to spend it that way, it is perfectly appropriate. This is a very important part of this agreement, is that this adequacy or this needs study be done. I too, am rather surprised that we were able to get to this agreement, but it's the result of a lot of very hard work by a variety of people, and I understand there's now peace in the valley. Madam Chair, I would point out, too, there's going to be an A2 amendment that adds some language, not only the language that is included in the A1. It's inclusive of that language, but also includes language limiting this agreement to the metro area, because that was the understanding of the original agreement. but it wasn't made clear in the original bill. And so there was some question about, does this apply to everybody statewide? And the agreement of all parties was, no, this was meant to be focused on the counties in the metro area. So there is an A2 amendment that will do that as well.
All right. Representative Gottwald, is the A2 amendment being copied right now? Is that?
That's my understanding, Madam Chair.
And so, in other words, we wouldn't need the A1 amendment if we had the A2 amendment. Okay.
That is true.
Representative Hamilton, I hate to do this to you, but I think what I want to do is temporarily lay this on the table. Let's get the paperwork caught up here with us. Representative Gunther's in the room. We can take his bill up. My apologies that we're not completely ready here.
That's fine. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. And with that, we'll lay Senate File 248.
Madam Speaker.
Temporary on the table.
I'm sorry. Madam Chair, I just wanted to clarify. You were laying the bill over temporarily,
yes,
correct?
Yes. We're waiting for an A2 okay. amendment to be copied
just
and distributed.
Just wanted to clarify.
Again.
You were laying it over temporarily.
Yeah, temporarily. Okay. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. House File 1721 is the Redevelopment Loan Fund, and the bill expands the existing redevelopment program to include loans for demolition purposes. It would allow loans to local units of government who need to remove blighted structures from their communities but do not have the immediate redevelopment plan of the site. The bill also changes the reporting cycle from a semi-annual to an annual for the contaminated cleanup program. Assumptions: the bill creates a statutory authority for the demolition loan portion of the program but does not appropriate any funds. Therefore, there is no fiscal impact. It is estimated that the change from a semi-annual to an annual reporting will save approximately $200 per year in staff time and printing costs. Expenditures and or revenue formulas not available. Long-term fiscal consideration: if the funds are appropriated for this program, deed will be required to administer any loans issued on a long-term basis. If funds are local government cost. If funds are appropriated for this program, local governments will be allowed to borrow funds and would need to repay the loans with interest. Reference sources, Meredith Neubach, blah, blah, blah. So basically what this does is it instead of having grants automatically issued from the redevelopment fund, which has been less than necessary, I have a list showing how many are requested and how many are given. This is a loan program to take up the slack and to allow communities to get rid of blighted buildings in anticipation of doing something with that land in a redevelopment way. And I'd certainly love to try to entertain any questions you have.
All right, members, at this point, if there's any questions, otherwise there's a number of amendments as well. Representative?
Madam Chair, just a clarification. Representative Gunther, you had said savings of $200. Is that what you really meant to say?
That's what I really meant to say.
Okay.
That's on personnel costs
okay.
from going from 1 year to instead of
okay.
two.
I understand. We're not used to hearing those small numbers. I just thought there was a mistake. So,
just wanted to make you feel good.
All right. Representative Gunther, what amendments would you like the committee to consider? What amendment?
Madam Chairman, the A4 amendment, the A3 will pull that one, and the A4 amendment is one pertaining to an excess sewage capacity for the city of Albert Lea because they had a packing plant burned down. They have a treatment plant that has more capacity than they need. So they want to be able to take that and use it as an economic development tool to entice businesses to come into their community.
All right, members. Representative Gunther moves the A4 amendment. Are there any questions? Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Representative Gunther. I'm looking on line 1.10. It said the rebate program may not result in increased charges to current users. Well, what if somebody coming in and asking for a rebate was a competitor of a current user? So the current user would be paying this price, and the new person would be paying this price. Is that competitively fair?
Representative Gunther.
Madam Chairman, Representative Wagenius, that would not be competitively fair, no. But if the two businesses were the same size and used the same amount, it would be charged the same amount. They are being charged less because they don't have to build anything in the future.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But the way this is written, that a new business can get a rebate, and I understand where you're going and trying to use the capacity, and that all sounds good to me, but it's this fairness issue. So a new business gets a rebate. An old business has the same charge that it's always had. What if these two are competitors is my question.
What if the rebate program to offset the cost to attract a new employer in the area. The city agrees to this legislation and will allow it to do so. So this is something that the city is doing. They're coming with a program to entice businesses to come into the community.
Madam Speaker?
Representative Wagenius, I'm the chair.
Madam Speaker, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wagenius.
It still is not answering the question of you've got two people that are competing, and one is getting a benefit and the other, because they've been there longer, is not getting this same benefit. And that's a problem that I think. Even though I think the outcome of what you want for Albert Lea to attract other businesses might be better served by just lowering everybody's rates.
Representative Wagenius, maybe, is there anybody in the audience from the Albert Lea community or that's familiar with this provision in Representative Benson's bill? Representative Gunther.
Madam Chair and Representative Wagenius, as long as the business coming in isn't competing for the same business, the advantage would be to have that business bring in more people to pay property taxes, more people to pay schools, bring kids into schools, so that they would all benefit in an equal way there. The amount of rebate they would get would be determined by the local governing body. So as long as they aren't competing, they would all benefit from this.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on lines 1.5, it says Albert Lea may, by ordinance, establish. So if any of the businesses have an issue with it, they can take it up to City Council. I think what Representative Gunther is just giving them another tool in the toolbox to attract new businesses. So once again, if any existing business have an issue with it, simply take it up to City Council.
Any additional questions on the A4 amendment? Seeing none, Representative amendment. Seeing none, Representative Gunther renews his motion to adopt the A4 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. A4 amendment is adopted. Representative Gunther, which amendment's next?
A7, Madam Chairman.
All right, Representative Gunther moves the A7 amendment.
Madam Chairman, this amendment simply allows a small business advocate office to be established in the Business Assistance Center, or DEED, to provide a one-stop for small businesses in need of information or assistance in obtaining renewed licenses, meeting state regulations, requirements, or resolving disputes. Basically, it provides one-stop access for small businesses, information and assistance in obtaining or renewing licenses or meeting regulatory requirements, resolves disputes with the state agency, resolving disputes of conflicting state agencies' position. In other words, it could be an ombudsman for those small businesses. I was anticipating that.
Representative Guinness.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Something we would all want on its face, but my question is, the governor's already signed the permitting bill, and how does this fit with that? Does it override, particularly this line 1.12, is this overriding the current, the bill that was just signed?
Representative,
Chairman, it complements it. It's not just necessarily environmental permits. There are many other types of permits that they will help with.
Any additional questions on the A7 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The A7 amendment is adopted. Representative Gunther.
Madam Chairman, I think that's all the amendments I have. I do believe there was one put in by Representative Davids. Oh, I take that back. I have the 0839 amendment.
All right, members, Representative Gunther moves the A12-0839 amendment. Would you like to explain your amendment to the committee, please?
Dan, where's that? It takes the money from... Okay. Madam Chairman and members, it takes the redevelopment funds from the general fund and puts them in a special account for deed so we can further give...
And Mr. Marks would like to add a little additional information here on your amendment.
Madam Chair and members, this is just moving a dedicated account out of the general fund into the special revenue fund. This is consistent with efforts we've had over the years to try and get dedicated revenues, dedicated spending out of the general fund and into special revenue funds or other places so that the general fund is undedicated as such.
All right, members, any questions on the A12-0839 amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Marks says, so then when we look at total state revenue and total state spending, do we include the dollars in when we talk about total, of course, it includes both, but in typical reporting of state spending and state revenue collection, we typically only report general revenue. Is that not correct?
Mr. Marks.
Madam Chair and Representative Biskins, anything that's general fund only, so any of the general fund discussion would not include it. I would mention this is a relatively small dollar amount. There's currently still about, two and a half million of dedicated receipts and dedicated spending in the general fund. So this is part of that overall amount.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Marks, do you have any idea about approximately on a biennial basis what the state spends in general fund as compared to what it spends in total funds?
Mr. Marks.
Madam Chair and Representative Biskin, let me find the precise numbers for the...
Mr. Marks, I have them too.
For the current biennium for fiscal years 2012 and 2013, general fund spending is projected to be $34,074 million. All funds spending, which would include the general fund as well as other funds, is... projected at $62.4 billion.
Representative Cuthbert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Biskins, deed, however, gets about $17 million. And the thing that most of us promised when we knocked on doors 2 years ago was to say we want to produce more jobs. I'm sorry. Since that time, we've taken 17% away from jobs committee. So it's hard to do what we promised without any money to do it with.
Representative Bissell.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Gunther. We can argue the semantics, but the bottom line is you say we take the money away from an agency. Some could argue that we allowed the money to be kept in the hands of the taxpayers.
Okay. Any additional questions on the A12-0839 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The amendment's adopted. Representative Gunther, is that all of your amendments for tonight?
Madam Chair, I'm sure that's the case.
All right, there are a couple other amendments in the packet. Does anyone want to claim them?
No.
Representative Davis.
Madam Chair, I have one. I'll withdraw it. Not sure what number it is.
All right. I believe yours might have been the A12-0903.
I'll withdraw that.
And my understanding is this has a little fiscal impact with it.
Minor details.
Yeah, just minor. Okay. Any other amendments? Representative Carlson.
That amendment, what happens to that Ford money then under current law then?
And it's my understanding that the forecast assumes that it goes to the general fund. So if somebody wanted to take that and repurpose it, they'd have to pay for it.
Okay.
So
I just was curious. This was something years and years ago that Representative Solberg and I worked on with that Ford plant, and they made a long-term commitment. And I'm not even sure where we are in that. That commitment from Ford, but it's like 20 years, I think, or something like that.
My understanding is that this general fund is anticipating that money coming to the general fund. Past that, I'm no expert. So.
Yeah, well, the amendment wasn't offered, so if it's offered at some point, I suppose we can have a discussion about that. I was just trying to recall. I don't know where we are in that 20-year cycle. It's been so long.
Any other questions on House File 1721 as amended? Representative Lencheski.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if Section 8 got amended. Representative Gunther, maybe it didn't, but Subdivision 3 of Section 8 is page 5 of the bill. Who can have their loan forgiven in this bill?
Representative Gunther.
You said section. What was the page 5?
Page 5, and it's line 5.26, Madam Chair.
5.26. Yeah, would you?
Looks like we're going to phone a friend here.
Phone a friend, huh?
Representative Gunther. Welcome to the committee, sir, if you'd like to state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mark Loftus. I'm the Director of Business and Community Development at DEED. Madam Chair, Representative Lencheski, you asked the question of whose loan would be forgiven here. These are structured as loans to the local government unit, and it would be when the structure of that loan would change when development would occur on that site, such that it's originally created as a loan, but if the development does occur, then our staff looks at it and considers whether it would qualify under the terms of the redevelopment grant program, in which case we would forgive up to 50% of the loan, including both principal and interest. Under the current redevelopment grant program, we make a grant. The city has to match that with 50%. We're going to do up to 50% of the project cost. If it's structured as a loan, when there is no intended development originally, no likely development, then later it becomes structured as a loan that's forgiven to the city.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lencheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is all new language in the bill, so I'm a little confused by your testimony. It sounded like you were saying that's currently the situation, yet the bill is implying this is new language. Is that currently going on?
Madam Chair, Representative Lencheski, under current law, just as the redevelopment grant program, we do a grant up to 50% of the cost of the project. Now, as a loan, if we're able to make a loan at the time the development occurs, we would look at that project and say, does it score under the redevelopment grant guidelines? And if it does, then we would, in effect, treat it as if it were made as a grant in the first place.
Representative Lencheski.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Then if that's the case, so that's doubling the business subsidy to the development, or the subsidy to the development, because the city is forgiven the loan, why isn't there a cost up to the bill?
Representative Gunther.
Madam Chair, I think that assumes there's money in the redevelopment loan program, our redevelopment program, to give them the grant. Redevelopment grants are given frequently, and it is one way we can have money redeveloped so we can put it eventually in building small businesses that will go and pay taxes.
Representative Lencheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Gunther, and I think I understand it now, and I certainly don't. You're the expert on this stuff, Representative Gunther, and so I guess maybe it's that, you know, if you choose to forgive it, then you probably can't have this grant money go quite as far as you would if you didn't forgive anybody, but, you know, I just would point out this morning we forgave a whole bunch of cities who didn't file for their LGA, and now this bill's going to forgive a bunch of folks who are supposed to pay back a loan, so... wouldn't be my priority, but thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Representative Breiner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick clarifying question for Mr. Loftus, and that's how would you prioritize the repayment of loans in relation to the actual giving of grants? So both are the grant dollars are limited, so how are you going to interface those two?
Mr. Loftus.
Madam Chair, Representative Breiner, I should have said earlier that the only way the demolition program works is if we have a general fund appropriation for that. So we can only do this with general fund monies, which we don't have in redevelopment today. Currently, as you recall, we did have $2 million from the special session that we have allocated in the most recent round. They would be treated separately, the loans versus the grants, depending on what funds we had.
Any additional questions? Seeing none, Representative Gunther renews his motion that House File 1721 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. No. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Gunther. Representative Hamilton, are you ready to go here? And members, we have the A2 amendment in front of us. As you can see from the time date stamp, it did not meet our preference for amendments. It's being passed out, is my understanding. Actually, it looks like it was prepared last week but not submitted to the committee until very recently. So I'll leave it to the will of the committee. I would hope they would consider the A2 amendment. I, like Representative Slawick stated earlier, if there's peace in the valley on what has been a huge Hatfield versus McCoy's fight around here for years and years, I would recommend to the committee that we amend this bill and move it out of here. But if anybody has major heartburn, let me know now.
Yeah. And Madam Chair.
Representative Hamilton.
And thank you for that, Madam Chair. And I did go out and speak with some of the individuals and try to hit them all that are in the room here to just make sure everybody's comfortable. Because like you said, I believe we found peace in the valley. This A2 amendment just clarifies what the original intent was. And I ask for your support.
All right, members in the audience, if I might... looks like you're still waiting for copies. We will get those to you, and then I'll ask if anybody opposes this, because we don't want to pull a fast one on anybody. But at this point, members, are there any questions on the A2 amendment? Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hamilton, I'm just trying to figure out, I mean, part of this obviously affects my part of the world, and that it does not apply to moving a machine from Maplewood to Woodbury, but otherwise, and that was in the original bill. Can you tell us what's the differences in the amendment? There's a lot of language here on this amendment.
Yes. I can. I know Representative Gottwald's raising his hand as well, so let's just let Representative Gottwald take that.
Representative Gottwald.
I thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Slawick, I appreciate the question. The first part that you see without new language added on the front page, lines 1.8 to basically 1.23, is our existing policy that the existing moratorium that would be allowed to expire on August 1st of 2014. We included the underlying language about the Woodbury facility. That's an old agreement that would be allowed to happen. I think we dealt with that, in fact, last year. So that's simply being clarified here and added for the purposes of keeping this all together. But that paragraph is the old moratorium that would be allowed to expire as of August 1st, 2014. Then we begin with paragraph C to dictate in greater detail that the counties that were always intended to be part of this agreement would be specified. And so that's why we put in new language. You've got the list of counties there, as you can see. That is the list of counties that the previous moratorium was applied to, and we want this new arrangement to apply to these going forward after August of 2014. So you see that it still requires that they be associated with a hospital. There's a 7-mile radius that has been negotiated. You've got the referring physician having a financial interest has to be disclosed. This was a huge issue for a lot of people and negotiated. Direct or indirect ownership has to be revealed, and a list of all the providers within that county area needs to be provided to a patient so they know they have other options available to them. Part of the reason we have all this underlined language is some of this was already in the bill, but it's been rearranged. It's been reorganized to just make sense better. But that is the whole of the amendment and the whole of the agreement, really. And then at the bottom, you see the appropriation, $137,000, that will be appropriated from the Health Care Access Fund. So that is really the long and short of the agreement. This amendment is mainly necessary for the appropriation portion and to specify the counties that this is involved in, because there was some question among the parties after the agreement was arrived at and the bill was written as to whether it applies to the entire state, and that was clearly not the intent.
Representative,
you know, Representative Gottwald, I think that you and I are on the same side. I think you know how this radiation facilities argument or debate has gone on for I think all of my 7 terms or 14 mm-hmm. years, if not, you know, and I was out for one, so 16 years maybe. And so it is important that it's, you know, it's amazing that there is a compromise. There's a lot of money involved, obviously, to these folks and to their practices and what's happening here. So I think it's a lot of changes. I mean, we're going to have to continue to review this, but are you satisfied that it meets the merits of it? And that it'd be nice if I could get a nod from the audience.
And Representative Slavik, once we get a little time, we'll ask for a show of hands if anybody has any concerns.
Okay.
I'll invite them down so they can express them.
Madam Chair, if I might, I would point out that this exact language we're looking at in the A2 amendment has been run by both of the parties that were involved in the previous moratorium, the primary stakeholders, and both of them are fine with this language. So, I think it's very appropriate to ask anybody in the audience if they have concerns about this, but this language simply more accurately reflects the agreement. And while there's a lot of underlying language, Representative Slawick, again, I think it's more of a reorganization of the language than it is. The only real new language here, other than the appropriation portion, is the section that specifies the counties. That was one thing we had not done before. It was kind of understood, but there was a desire to make it very clear that this does not apply outside of that area.
And Representative Gottwald, as I'm reading the language about the patient being given a list, I'm trying to find out where that is. 2-8, line 7 through, page 2, line 7 through 10. So is each patient that would get referred would get a list of all of the facilities in all of those counties on lines
you like.
Well, starting on page one and the first couple lines of page two.
Yeah. Madam Chair, if you are a referring physician within those counties listed in paragraph C, you will be asked, if you're referring them for radiation oncology, to give them that list, the list of all of the facilities or providers within those that county area. That was the agreement.
Oh, no, so you said within the county area. The way I read this is that a patient is going to get a list of all the facilities in all of those counties. Is
correct.
That your intent?
Correct. But if you look at paragraph D, beginning on line 2.7, it says any referring physician located within a county identified in paragraph C, so any referring physician in those counties must give a patient being referred for radiation oncology the list of all radiation facilities or providers in those counties as well. So it's referring physician giving the list to people for the facilities in that area.
So if I'm seeing a referring physician in Hennepin County, I'm going to get a list of all the facilities in the 7-county metro area, St. Louis, Sherburn, Benton, Stearns, Chisago, Isanti, and Wright.
That's correct.
Madam Chair, I think it's really there's two main providers, so it's a X facility or a Y facility, and so people would begin to understand, I think, the choices. And right now what they do is my understanding is correct, they can refer just to the one, so the physician can just direct them to one.
Right.
So it's making sure they have that choice. I think that makes sense. I mean, that's been the issue, is that are you feeding your own business, right? And now patients would have be aware of the choices.
All right, if I might, for those lobbyists in the room, is there anybody that would like to step to the stand to express any concerns about the A2 amendment? If so, raise your hand or hands. I don't see anybody. Wow, this is too good to be true. All right, Representative Hamilton, any questions on the A2 amendment? Representative Gotwell, did you move this? I'm sorry, or did
I did.
All right, Representative Hamilton renews his motion to adopt the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The A2 amendment is adopted. I believe you have the bill in the shape that you'd like it considered. Any additional questions or comments? Seeing none, Representative Hamilton.
I renew my motion to pass Senate File 248 as amended, be recommended pass, and be placed on the general register.
All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Senate File 248 as amended is on its way to the general register. Thank you to all that have worked out the resolution to that issue.
All right, Representative Holberg, did you want to move your bill?
Yes, I'd like to move House File 2340 for consideration by the committee.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. And did you want to describe the bill, or would you like to go right to the A3 amendment first?
Well, if I might, maybe we can take the A3 amendment. It addresses the fiscal note. This bill would provide a licensing procedure for facilities that perform abortions, and we got the fiscal note as we left Representative Abler's committee. He chose to not fill in an amount for the licensure cost, and so we could get a fiscal note. So what we've done here is, after the department provided the fiscal note that's in your packet, the amendment would make the licensing fee the same as other surgical centers, that being the $3,712, so that they would be treated the same. And then there's a general fund appropriation for the remaining balance of $33,000 to fully fund the costs delineated in the fiscal note.
Wow. Members, questions to the amendment?
So basically the A3 amendment sets the fee the same as everybody else and puts extra money from the general fund to cover the difference. In a brief discussion with the Department of Health, because there would be two visits, there'd be visits each year as opposed to every other year, that was the additional cost.
All right, so Representative Holberg has moved the H2340A3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The A3 is adopted. Representative Holberg, any final comments to the bill?
Well, again, very simply, this bill would require a licensure of abortion facilities, and the fiscal note takes, or the amendment took care of the fiscal costs in the bill. I'd be happy to stand for any questions as well.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Chair Holberg. On lines 9 through 11, I know this isn't fiscal, but I just had a quick question about is 10 or more women willfully terminated each month. Let's say there's one month where there's 12 women that have, you know, what would be determined as medical abortions. Let's say there's their life is threatened, or you know, they're, you know, would be one a medical abortion, and let's say there's 12 in one month. Would they then be covered by, would they be covered by this bill if it was just one month and it was not an elective kind of abortion?
Representative Holbrook.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hornstein, if they hit that standard, then they'd be required to be licensed.
So it does, anything over 10, that's the...
Yes.
Representative Holbrook.
Thank you.
Further discussions? Well, Representative Slawick, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Holberg, I'm just trying to understand. So you're going to charge a licensing fee of $3,712 per facility. How many facilities are there?
Representative Holberg.
Maybe I missed that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Slawick, currently there are 8. A fiscal note at one point allowed for what they thought would maybe be an additional 10 in the state, but I used the number of 8 in order to compute the fiscal costs and the remaining need for a general fund appropriation.
Mr. Chair, so I worked on a licensing of music therapists bill, and the way they do licensing, it is sort of this mathematical formula of how many people, and so they told you the annual cost of getting these inspectors from the Department of Health, how much that would cost divided by the number of facilities, and that it, then you get your per cost per facility. Is that how you're getting that?
Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Slawick, if you look under on page 2 of the fiscal note under the assumptions, it talked about the initial licensure activity would take about an average of 24 hours by staff, one inspection per year. Then they thought they would maybe conduct one complaint investigation per year.
So one of the issues in the music therapist licensure bill was I was a music therapist, so their fee came up quite high, several hundred dollars. Is how are they going to pay for that? So how are the facilities supposed to pay for this?
Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair and Representative Slawick, it would be a cost of their doing business.
Representative Slawick.
So Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, so their costs would go up? I guess they have to pass it on to the consumers, or...
Representative Holberg.
Madam Chair, Representative Slawick, I would believe that they probably would.
But she's only charging.
Representative Slawick?
No, it just strikes me, you know, as interesting to raise the cost. You know, you're raising the cost of a procedure potentially fairly significantly by adding this licensing part of it. And then, as we know, some of them are funded by government, and so maybe it's going to cost the government more overall. It seems like more government scrutiny, more, lot more language, and a lot more cost. Doesn't seem like it makes a lot of sense to me, but I guess that's my opinion.
With that, Representative Holberg, any final comments? Or Representative Hornstein?
Just one last quick question. This is a fiscal one, Madam Chair. On the revenue note, on the fiscal note, it talks about fees of $7,950 per licensee. but then in the A3 amendment, it's 3,712. So where would the remaining, I guess, 3,000-something come from?
Representative Holberg.
And again, you maybe need to go back to the A3 amendment. Again, as the bill left Representative Abler's committee, we left the appropriation number blank. As Representative Slawick referenced, trying to get a feel for cost of implementing the programming and then backing into a fee. We didn't want to charge a higher amount for these facilities than for other surgical centers. So you'll see on line 1.3 of the amendment the annual fee cost of $3,712, which is what other surgical centers are charged by the Department of Health. And then the additional appropriation of $33,000 on lines 14 and 15 would then take up the difference. In other words, buying down the cost of the $7,900 per facility so that it would match the cost of other surgical centers.
Thank you.
Mr. Hornsey? Anyone else? Well, with that, Mr. Holberg renews her motion that House File 2340 as amended pass and be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is on its way. And members, I don't believe we have any other business, so
no,
we...
Thank you, Mr.
Representative
Chair
Holberg.
And committee, and we will not meet tomorrow, but plan for an 8 a.m. Wednesday meeting.
Thank you, everybody. We are adjourned.